Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Item one, debt and deficits are not the same thing. Item two, and as a result, it's entirely possible that Washington is having the wrong conversation. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 25th of February. Good as always to have you with us. So there are a few places to start a program on business and the economy at the moment, other than with the big budget cuts. They're going to start happening on Friday, so that's where we will start. But do me a favor and bear this in mind as this week unwinds. Those cuts are pretty directly tied to government spending and the size of the federal deficit. That is the amount we're in the hole each and every year. But there is another part of that equation, the much, much bigger national debt. And that the debt is a consensus concern in Washington right now has a lot to do with one guy, a guy who has spent millions of his own dollars over the past 30 years to make it so. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
These days, this seems to be the starting point for almost every conversation in Washington.
We now have a $16.4 trillion national debt, as big as our economy.
We've set a target of cutting $4 trillion out of the deficit over the next 10 years.
One component to growing our economy and broadening opportunity for the middle class is shrinking our deficits in a balanced and responsible way.
But there are plenty of smart people who think politicians' priorities are wrong. Dean Baker heads the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
I think it's this very, very perverse situation. We're sort of focused on what's really not the issue.
The recovery's not over, Baker says. Unemployment is still too high. Mary Kay Henry agrees with him. She's the president of the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU.
We need, as a nation, to understand that the debt issue, while important, is not job one.
The Tea Party is taking credit for this week's standoff, but the fixation on our debt? Jim Thurber teaches government at American University, and he says credit for that goes to a guy who was Commerce Secretary during the Nixon administration.
I think Pete Peterson certainly has helped push this onto the agenda.
Pete Peterson and nearly half $1 billion of his own money. Peterson co-founded a private equity firm called the Blackstone Group, and he was chairman and CEO of Lehman Brothers. Thurber says Peterson has been passionate about the debt and the deficit for decades.
Well, I think that he's focused on this issue in a singular way. He has a clear strategy, theme, and message of let's fix the debt, let's do something about the deficit.
And he's done that by giving money to a long list of think tanks and advocacy groups.
Bipartisan Policy Center.
Center for American Progress.
Campaign to Fix the Debt.
Coalition for Fiscal and National Security.
Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Committee for Economic Development.
America Action Forum.
Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Comeback America Initiative.
New America Foundation.
Peterson
America
commissions studies and sponsors projects. One of the best-known advocates for deficit reduction is Maya McGinnis. She heads two groups Peterson supports. She hosted a kickoff event for the newest one last summer.
So the Campaign to Fix the Debt is going to bring together CEOs, business leaders, former members of Congress, budget experts, economists, but most importantly, voters across the country.
Jim Thurber at American University estimates it's already spent at least $25 million on ad campaigns and big events.
Now, whether it will help resolve our situation or not is another question. That is about political will.
Peterson would agree it's about political will, and while his focus has been on the long term, politics have led to this week's short-term fight over sequestration. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the program, a talk with Pete Peterson about debt and deficits and how they became the topics of national conversation. On Wall Street today, yeah, no, not so good. Suffice it to say, we're not going to have to worry about Dow 14,000 anytime soon. Details, numbers, when we get there. Big day for Barnes & Noble today. Shares up almost 11.5%. Seems the chairman of the board of directors, Leonard Riggio, wants to buy part of the company, the retail stores and the website specifically, and take it private. That would leave the unprofitable ebook division, Nook Media, public and on its own, which, given that we're told e-readers are the wave of the future, raises a whole bunch of questions. Here's Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson.
Question number one, why would anyone want to own a bookstore? Well, for starters, after borders closed, Barnes & Noble became the last man standing of the big national booksellers. Michael Norris is a publishing industry analyst with Simba Information. He says despite all the hype around ebooks,
people still buy print books, and people who buy digital books, about 3 out of 4, still buy print.
And Barnes & Noble bookstores still turn a profit. Question number two, why not keep the digital side? Answer, the Nook runs in third place to Apple's iPad and Amazon's Kindle. And it'll take a lot of money and time to turn it from an also-ran into a real moneymaker. Peter Wahlstrom is an analyst with Morningstar.
The devices, they're very nice. They're competitive. The tough part is that the Nook is not top of mind with the consumer.
Question three. If Riggio takes the profitable bookstore business private, are investors getting hosed? What is left for them? Answer, in addition to the Nook, there are hundreds of college bookstores.
They are repackaging the bookstore into the college store, and college stores don't close down.
Al Greco, a marketing professor at Fordham University, says all those students buying textbooks and T-shirts offer up a nice, reliable chunk of change. So the fourth and final question, Greco says, is whether that college business can support the Nook while it tries to turn a profit. And that one, he says, we can't answer yet. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We publicly mourned the death of inflation last week, motivated by a report saying the consumer price index had risen exactly 0.0% the past 2 months. It was an obituary quite a few steps too soon to judge by your letters. Dennis Sadum in Walla Walla, Washington, was one of many who got in touch.
Anybody who thinks inflation is dead is living in a dream world and are certainly not living on a fixed income as I am, because believe me, inflation is alive and very well.
All right, so how is it that inflation is officially zero when so many people feel their paychecks don't go as far as they used to? Marketplace's David Weinberg put that question to some people who ought to know.
I called up Mark Toma, a professor of economics at the University of Oregon, and I told him about all the comments we got from people who said that for them, inflation is real. His response?
They're probably right.
Toma says that some people's individual inflation rate is not zero. That 0% rate that was released last week, that's an average based on the Consumer Price Index, or CPI. The CPI is made up of thousands of different goods and services. But not everyone buys the same goods and services. For example, take Dennis Sadam, whose comment you heard earlier. He's retired. He was born in 1944. So he probably spends a larger percentage of his income on healthcare than the average person.
Healthcare is very expensive. It's rising way faster than the regular rate of inflation.
So elderly people are going to have a personal rate of inflation that is higher than the average. And even if you aren't buying a lot of healthcare, take for instance a gallon of milk, which is one of the thousands of items in the CPI. That gallon of milk may not cost the same in Wisconsin as it does in Walla Walla. And for people who buy a lot of milk where it's expensive,
they have a personal inflation rate, you know, that would be not only those goods, but the local prices that they pay based on their suppliers.
Peter Kleinow teaches economics at Stanford. He says just because inflation is at zero doesn't mean the price of everything has stayed the same. It just means that for the things that have gone up in price, there are other items in the CPI that have gone down to counterbalance the average. And that doesn't even take into account wages. On average, wages do increase over time. But for many people, especially low-skilled workers and people on fixed incomes, their inflation rate feels very real and very much alive. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
For all that we like to think our smartphones and tablets are living, breathing extensions of ourselves, the truth is that technology is really kind of impersonal, right? It's just a bunch of electrons and silicon, after all. Which is why the prospect of more technology in medicine is getting some attention. Even Watson, the supercomputer from Jeopardy, is in the picture. It's reviewing case histories and then making diagnoses and treatment recommendations. Jonathan Cohn has the cover story in the new edition of the Atlantic Monthly. It's about technology and medicine and what it all means for the future. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So I know you probably didn't get to pick this title, but I must say that The Robot Will See You Now does nothing to create warm and fuzzies about technology and medicine.
Yeah, no, I didn't pick the title, and I'm bracing myself for the reaction from patients, but particularly physicians, including my father. Uh-huh. You know, I guess I should state for the record, number one, I'm not saying that robots will replace your doctor. I'm not even saying they should, but that we may be getting to a point where we are going to see some profound changes. And we might even see a few robots. But more than that, we're going to see very intelligent computers, and we're going to see a lot of use of data.
Lots to talk about in there, obviously. Let's start with the most obvious, which is how is this going to save us money, bend the curve in the healthcare economics debate parlance?
When we talk about these innovations, there are really two ways that it might save us money. The first, I think, is the one that most people are probably familiar with, and that's the sense that, you know, technology can make healthcare more efficient. We can eliminate errors. We can reduce waste. It's actually the second aspect of saving money that I think is more interesting, and this gets into the way that technology and these innovations might change who gives healthcare. Doctors are really expensive. It costs a lot to pay a doctor. That's one of the reasons healthcare is so expensive in this country. But if instead of having doctors do all of this work, some of that work is in effect farmed out to a team of people, each of whom is trained for their job and can use this technology to do it, well then actually healthcare can get a little less expensive.
So I'm obliged to mention here as we talk about technology and healthcare that the one big experiment really, the one big clinical trial, if you will, about technology in medicine, electronic health records, hasn't really panned out. I mean, how are we doing so far?
Well, you know, if you want a reason to be skeptical about any of these
okay,
innovations,
okay,
you know,
give me a reason.
This is it.
Yeah.
And I should say that, you know, if we don't get the electronic medical records right, all this other stuff, it's going to be a lot harder because so many of these innovations really depend on up-to-date, detailed medical information.
Will there come a day, though, when I'm in the hospital having my appendix out or whatever it is, and it's time for morning rounds, and around the corner comes Watson on wheels beeping and sidling up to my bed and asking me how I feel? I mean, is that where we're going?
I should say there are serious, incredible people who I think would answer that question, yes. In the end, I still think we're not going to ever replace doctors. You know, the analogy I use is this isn't, you know, if you're a science fiction fan, this isn't the robot, you know, putting on the new hand on Luke Skywalker in Star Wars. You know, it's Dr. McCoy walking around with his tricorder, you know, using it to analyze information.
Jonathan Cohn is a senior editor at The New Republic. His article in The Atlantic Monthly this month is called The Robot Will See You Now. It's about technology and medicine. Jonathan, thanks a bunch.
Thank you for having me.
Marissa Meyer, the still somewhat newish boss at Yahoo, has been doing her level best to keep employees happy. Free food, iPhones for everybody, gym memberships. But her latest idea does not seem to be going over so well. No more working from home is the new rule at all. So we called up our own Queen of Kim to talk required attendance and workplace productivity. Wait. Is there an editor around here, please?
Yes, speaking.
Wait, isn't Queen of working today?
Well, I think she is, but come to think of it, I haven't heard from her.
Oh, working from home. Coming up,
I do have to sign this riveting, compelling, electrifying White Soul Sister, Janis Joplin, in this group, Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Janis Joplin and who? A conversation with music producer Clive Davis straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Worries that Italy might retreat from its austerity kick had investors on edge today. There was an election over there this past weekend. The Dow Industrials dropped 216 points, partly as a result. About 1.5% for the blue chips, ended at 13,784. The NASDAQ shed 45 points, 1.4%, finished at 3116. The S&P 500 down 27 points, 1.8%, settled at 1487. Financial stocks led the decline. Shares of Morgan Stanley withdrew 6.5%. Goldman Sachs off more than 4% today. Energy stocks ran out of gas as well. ConocoPhillips fizzled 2.25%. Chevron leaked 2%. ExxonMobil sputtered lower by 1.75%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.87%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for the month of January. Made any home improvements? You may have been to Home Depot. It reports quarterly earnings. And happy birthday to Fats Domino. He'll be 85. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. When the budget cuts go into effect on Friday, it could conceivably be bad. To hear the president and his allies describe it, we're about to unleash an economic monster upon ourselves. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer how bad it could be.
Wretched travelers languishing in long, winding airport security lines. Visitors barred from swaths of national parks. Meat shortages in the supermarket. It's Washington's version of a Frankenstein movie, and the Obama administration is ratcheting up the drama to convince Congress to delay the massive budget cuts known in Washington as the sequester. The dire warnings would have us believe the sequester monster will break out of its cage at the stroke of midnight on March 1st and rampage through the federal government. But some Washington wonks think the monster won't flex its muscles right away and actually may not have any muscles.
The sequester is probably more like a blob.
Jim Kessler is a policy analyst at Third Way, a Washington think tank.
It's not like you're going to see rumbling earthquakes as Frankenstein walks down the street. It has a more subtle effect.
Kessler says we won't feel the brunt of the sequester's wrath until around the end of March, because much of the budget cutting will come in the form of unpaid leave for federal workers, and they have to have 30 days' notice first. But if Congress and the White House can't come up with a deal to shove the sequester back in its cage before April, watch out. Stan Collender is a budget expert now at Corvus Communications. He says, remember how the Frankenstein movies end?
Once the sequester happens and the peasants start to storm the castle with pitchforks, the politics of this will change and the average member of Congress is going to get a lot of pressure to just stop it one way or another.
And Collender says if the sequester monster isn't stopped, the peasants just may turn their pitchforks on the politicians. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
We have a tendency in this country to imagine everybody else in the whole world wants to come live here. And a lot of people do. But there is a new survey out from Gallup that puts migration into some context. Back in 2007, 21% of Mexicans wanted to move out of their country. That figure is now down to 11%. Curiously, the same proportion of Americans, 11%, want to move to another country. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler got a sense of where Americans want to go and why.
If rocker Bob Seger had his way, he'd leave the U.S. for Spencer Manners didn't move so far away. He set up a nursery business in Nicaragua.
Because Nicaragua is a low-cost country to live in, your standard of living is really quite good compared to other places. Your dollar goes much farther in things like purchasing homes and buying food.
In Mexico, Peter St. John bought a three-bedroom, three-bath house for $60,000. But that's not why he left Cincinnati.
It was the climate, even more than the winters. I ran away from the summers. Hot and humid.
Jan Steinman left Oregon and settled in British Columbia, Canada.
I'm a healthcare refugee from the U.S. Here in Canada, I have free healthcare.
And if you're interested in moving to Canada, Jan's farming co-op is looking for new recruits. In Los Angeles, but dreaming of Kathmandu, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
If you think about some of the biggest musical acts of the last, 50 years or so, Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan, Springsteen, Aretha Franklin, Miles Davis, one guy has worked with them all. Clive Davis started as a lawyer, and then, as even he will tell you, by pretty much being in the right place at the right time, he wound up running Columbia Records in the 1960s. He started Arista Records in the 70s. Today, he's the chief creative officer at Sony Music Entertainment, and he's got a new memoir out. It's called The Soundtrack of My Life. Mr. Davis, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to start with a question about risk, but I'm going to frame it the way you do in your book, about a decision you made that changed your life, changed your business, and it revolves around this woman and this song. Janis Joplin, obviously. You go out to Monterey in the mid-ish 60s, right? You see her on stage, and you say, I have to sign this woman. Talk to me for a second about the risk and the gamble that that was for you.
Well, it was 1967. I had been head of the company for a little over a year. I certainly had never signed an artist. I was watching.
Wait a minute. Back up for a minute. You had never signed an artist before you signed Janis Joplin?
No, she was the first artist I ever signed.
Wow.
I had not been remotely aware what was going on at Haight-Ashbury and the Love, Peace, and Flowers. And so that for me, seeing a new revolution in the making, sensing it, and getting that, could I say, tingle on my spine, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. I really have to sign this riveting, compelling, electrifying white soul sister, Janis Joplin, in this group, Big Brother, and the holding company.
You bet the company in some way, right?
Oh, I didn't bet the company. No.
Well,
you
paid a lot of money for this woman and her band.
Well, look, I paid by the contract. It cost $200,000, and half of it, would be borne by the company. So I don't want to be melodramatic, and I urge you not to be. No, I'm not a gambler.
Well,
so this is not a question of risk here in my mind. It was different. It was following an instinct and signing an artist with great determination, and it proved that it was worthwhile.
There's a line in here that kind of applies. You say at the point you got offered the job at Columbia, you say, unfortunately, I knew nothing of music to speak of. And that's a quote from you. So the question is...
Well, I endorse that without question.
Well, so how, as you gained experience in this business, how did you make the decisions you did? Was it gut?
It was gut. I found that I had an ear that I never knew that I had. And so that, yes, when Janis made it, the Electric Flag, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Chicago, Santana, they all made it. And so, of course, that began to build my confidence.
There is a management guide buried in this book a little bit, and it comes out in a paragraph fairly early on where you talk about how to capitalize on change in an industry and how it's not sufficient to sit back and look at past glories. How do you do that in an industry that has changed over the 40 years you've been in it as much as music has?
Well, you've also got to know what you're good at and what you need help at. So that when R&B music was changing, you know that hip-hop revolution is coming. I'm not good at going to the streets, but I found Puffy. And I financed Bad Boy Records, and with the Notorious B.I.G. and Mace, we had years of success. If you can do it yourself, fine. But if it's going to be other forms of music with his other expertise, make sure you get the right team and the right people to work with.
So after you and I get off the phone, you're going to talk to Ryan Seacrest, which makes me think of this question. Do you suppose it's possible, just because Ryan is turning into something of an impresario himself these days, right? He seems to be everywhere. Is it possible for a kid coming up in music today what you have done?
I do think it is. I mean, I know that a few years ago I was concerned about the degree of piracy, concerned out there with this digital revolution that people think that music should be gotten for nothing. But I put on the Lumineers or Miguel. I'm really optimistic that the identifiable individualistic artist is there. Someone young today can come along, and if they have ears and taste and they have financial backing, they could have major success. I truly believe that.
One last thing, Mr. Davis, before I let you go. Did I read it right in here that when you were a kid, you were a Bing Crosby guy over a Frank Sinatra guy? Really?
You know, you read it and it was true, but let me make it clear. Frank Sinatra was the greatest interpreter of song. He is indeed still the king.
Chairman of the board. Elvis was the king. Come on.
I'll take it. Chairman of the board.
All right.
Amendment.
Very good.
Okay.
Clive Davis, his new book, it's a memoir. It's called The Soundtrack of My Life. Mr. Davis, thanks very much for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This final note on the way out, in which Boris Johnson, the mayor of the City of London, says about lawmakers what a lot of people here have been thinking. Johnson went before the London Assembly today, the city's version of a legislature, to talk about millions of pounds worth of budget cuts that are coming. Assembly members apparently had no questions for him, none at all, which brought this response from the notoriously outspoken Mr. Johnson.
Are you saying they haven't the guts to put questions to me?
What
great
is it,
supine protoplasmic invertebrate jellies. That's it. They don't want to ask me any questions.
Next member of Congress we get on this show, I am totally calling a great supine protoplasmic invertebrate jelly. Totally. All right, we got to go. Yeah, and then I'll get fired, right? All right, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 216 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 45 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 down 27 points, 1.8%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Padokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.